It's Gerard Whateley. Thanks for listening to the podcast. In this episode, with the Darren Weir arrest story breaking and shocking the racing world, author and journalist Andrew Rule joined me on a Super Bowl front. We met our expert for the call, Larry Fitzgerald, plus Hall of Fame prospect Tony Boselli, and the Ringer's editor-at-large Brian Curtis. And we touched base with Peter Lawler ahead of the final test of the cricket summer. Get in touch with the program at any time, whateley@sen.com.au. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. A man who follows these things particularly closely is Brian Curtis, editor-at-large with The Ringer, and part of this program from the very outset. Brian, welcome.
How are you, Jared?
Not too bad. What have you made of the day?
I liked your phrase, extraordinary moment of misjudgment, because so much of the Super Bowl is, in fact, such a moment of misjudgment. It's been fascinating. You know, I think as a media member, this is incredibly fun. And I don't want to ever say that you and I would, for a moment, be sad to be here, because we are wonderfully lucky to be here. But some of this is to be endured rather than, you know, sort of actually enjoyed, I think. And, you know, I also think when it comes to journalism at the Super Bowl, I said this the other day, getting sent to the Super Bowl as an American reporter is 90% about status. I've made it, right?
Yep.
And it's 10% about actual written product that you will produce that will enlighten anyone to what's going to happen in the game. And I think we've hit about that balance this week.
I think my observation today was the beat reporters who are doing the serious reporting around the football game were largely absent from the media gatherings. It was to fuel the spectacle, as it were.
That's right. And I know you're a wrestling fan.
Yes.
And they really did owe a lot to WWE last night. I mean, there were catwalks with players coming down them and, you know, a loud announcer on the stage. And we were supposed to be interviewing people, but there was a guy on the speaker. There was a crowd in the stands like you'd see at a wrestling event watching us interview the players. Just truly an amazing event. And you're right. It's about getting people excited. And it's about hype. And it's about something to do. And on that level, it's probably a success.
That was the great curiosity to me, that 10,000 people would be put into the arena and there was nothing to see. Like, so after you do your entrances and your monologue, they at least get down to wrestling. So you did the entrances and the monologue, and then everyone gets sent home.
Yeah, I wanted to tell these people, you might think there's something glamorous about sports writing in interviewing athletes. Trust me when I say, in this venue, there is not. And you're going to be seeing the backs of our heads, and they are going to not be answering, doing their best not to answer our questions.
There was a post-game show to opening night where there were five sitting around on the NFL Network dissecting essentially what wasn't said. They did have the good grace to sort of preface everything with, there was nothing of any substance said tonight.
Which kind of ruled out the analysis that then they would do at that point, but I'm sure they continued.
So the players are in on the joke, though, aren't they?
Yes.
It is, Sports Illustrated described it as a circus, but it's a circus that there is that... They're glad to be a part of it. This is the build up to the grand final.
In a way, the less serious the questions are, the easier it is for them.
Yeah.
Right? Because the last thing they want is to be grilled about a particular aspect of gameplay or their personal life or their relationship with a teammate. Right? They want silly things. There was a clown there, by the way, a media member who I actually know from Dallas, dressed in a clown suit. And I noticed that the media members talked to the players for about 9 minutes, and then they turned and said, well, why don't we interview you, because you're wearing a clown suit.
Right.
So that was... But I think in the players, it's kind of weirdly a safe space, because they don't mind wacky questions. Wacky questions don't matter. It's tough, thoughtful, you know, little questions that get them.
The CBS press conference, so Channel 7's our free-to-air broadcaster in Australia with the football, so they had a press conference where everybody was introduced, including the producer and the director, the on-air talent, the off-air talent, the administration. It was such a big cast that they couldn't all fit on the show, the podium. But Tony Romo, all the questions were for Tony Romo. So star quarterback pulls a pin on his career a fraction early.
That's right.
To take this opportunity as the colour man. And then absolutely excels at the key moment last week.
I've never seen anything like this. Both his performance last week, where he seemed to have the second sight and was divining the plays before they happened. I've just never seen that happen in a broadcast. On the other hand, I've also never seen this, where the announcer of the Super Bowl is a top five storyline at the Super Bowl.
Yep.
And as you and I were sitting in that press conference together today, I think Tony Romo is as in demand this week as anybody except maybe Tom Brady, and you could make an argument for Todd Gurley, but I don't think so, among the players in the game. I've never seen that before.
Nope.
And I'm too young for Beatlemania, and I think you are too, Jared. That was like Beatlemania tonight. People, a woman from Extra, the tabloid show, was, "What's your hype song, Tony?" You know, I guarantee Troy Aikman didn't get that question the last time Fox had the Super Bowl. I don't know that, you know, there's been this kind of pop culture interest in an announcer.
Yeah, and Jim Nantz, who's one of the great voices of American sport, is, I spent a little bit of time around him in the aftermath, and all he was getting was questions about Tony Romo.
I know, and here's a guy who's been on network television here for 34, almost 40 years, and all the questions are, what's Tony Romo really like? Can you tell us, Jim? And you notice that Tony kind of made an exit after about 40 minutes of questioning, and Jim was left to answer questions about Tony Romo.
So he described it as sort of his novelty act is... he didn't want to delve too deeply into it, which I think is probably around not setting an absurd, although the bar's already absurd come Sunday, but almost trying not to feed that, as he was self-deprecating to a fault. He described it as guessing and as the novelty act. It was a pretty good approach, I thought, just to try to not get wound up in something which is a real thing.
Totally, because the nature of the press conference is like we were all visiting a psychic. And, you know, I said, Tony, tell me about my life. Tony, will I have good success at my job over the next couple of years? And he actually did predict the exact score of the game. And I don't think he was kidding, by the way. He said that it was going to be 28-24.
And the team on 24 would have the ball at the end but wouldn't score.
Right, right. He didn't tell us the winner, but he did give that incredibly specific detail.
Yeah, yeah. So is this a typical build-up to a Super Bowl, or does this have elements which have sort of elevated or skewed it in different directions?
I think it's pretty typical. I think what's different is the announcement that we just talked about, and the fact that the Patriots, every time they do this, and this is time number 9 in the Tom Brady era, it just accrues a little more, I don't know if it's heft, but a little more edge, because they're such a divisive team. And they've also made it their theme to be divisive about the media. Even though, I don't know if you saw this, the official Patriots account was tweeting out a clip of someone on one of the Fox shows here saying that the Patriots dynasty was over. This is the official team account, is now trolling media members. So I think from our standpoint, I've never seen it be adversarial like that on purpose. You know, you hear a comment here, but that's sort of the official line, is adversarial with the media. We're going to win this in spite of you.
That dynamic, so they claimed underdog status for themselves. Now, whether that was to motivate their own team or how exactly to set it, and they were literal underdogs coming into those two games, but there is a resentment around them daring to claim underdog status, which I've sort of been reading.
They've only been underdogs a handful of times since, like, 2016 in any game. So, you know, I think you were helping me, you know, understand the Patriots are sort of like, was it Hawthorne? Yeah, and it's sort of like Hawthorne came into every season and said, we don't have a chance. We're never gonna win the grand final again. That's sort of what this act is like.
So sport dominating the headlines at the moment with the raid on Darren Weir's stables. Andrew Rules, one of the country's best journalists. He's always had an eye towards crime, but his heart towards racing. He's written the Winx book. Andrew, welcome to SEN.
Good description. Thank you, Jared. Yes, interesting times today in the Weir camp.
What do you think on a day like this, Andrew, for a sport that you and I are obviously both deeply passionate about but can let you down sometimes?
It does. As you and I have probably said to other people, Jared, if racing doesn't have enough good feel-good stories, the space is filled by the bad stories, and this is one of those days, I think. This raid at Weir's stables follows weeks and weeks, several weeks of speculation and rumour about him being raided.
How significant do you feel like it is, Andrew? He is the dominant figure in Melbourne racing and has been for some time.
It is a significant event if anything he's proved against Weir or his staff, and that is yet to be seen. We can't assume guilt. We don't really know what's going on. There is some talk of a device being found, which is some sort of electrical shock device of some sort. Talk of a firearm, although I wouldn't worry about the firearm thing. I don't think that's sinister. A lot of people have a gun at a set of stables in case of snakes or accidents or whatever. That's not an issue. But there is rumour of other substances, but I don't think we can go into that at this point.
Yeah, so the electrical device, would that be... So the jigger is what is sometimes spoken about.
It is. Jiggers take many forms. I think when they use the term jigger loosely, it can be a small transportable device which is used on horses. The rider administers it to a horse while it's working or while it's racing. There are also other versions of that, I understand, where perhaps the shock is administered to the horse while it is on a treadmill or something like that. Because some trainers feel that an electrical shock at some point encourages the horse to try harder, and I don't know if it does, but it's certainly widely held in the dark side of racing that is the case. And I might point out that the legendary trainer of Secretariat and other good horses was once banned from riding as a jockey because of using a jigger. So it's been around a long time.
The push and pull, Andrew, is so Racing Victoria, it's their sport to run and to keep clean. This always has the dual effect, is if they are moving to keep racing clean, the net effect is it looks seedy and crooked in the process. And that's... Sometimes I feel that they walk a line which is just so difficult.
I feel very sorry for them because they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't. And my feeling, which might be wrong, and it's certainly been proven wrong today, my feeling is that sometimes they would rather prosecute small players who don't make big headlines as a warning to bigger players who would make big headlines. And I know that the small trainers, rightly or wrongly, and they might be wrong, feel persecuted because they feel that they get policed more rigorously than some of the big names because the big names would be bad publicity. Well, that theory has taken a beating today, although perhaps it's more police and others acting today than the racing authorities, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I really don't know yet.
No, and we wait for further facts to come to hand. Racing Victoria has put out a statement. We think Victoria Police are about to do the same. Does the reputation of racing suffer badly on a day like this? And does it ever fully recover? Or are there always people who will think the worst of the sport?
I think it does. I think where it hurts most, I think that, dyed-in-the-wool followers of it have always seen it for what it is and what it isn't. But it's the people in the middle, the people, that, like the sort of people you may know socially through, say, your children's school, who might be inclined, because they're respectable accountants or whatever they might be, to take a share in a horse for a bit of fun with their friends. I reckon that is the market that is hurt by this, because they go, well, why would we have anything to do with that? I feel that that's where the damage is done, not so much against lifetime followers of the game, who are numerically fairly small, a fairly small number, really, lifetime followers. Is that true, do you think?
Yep.
Yeah. I feel it's a bit harder to sell a share in a, I race a horse or two with tiny shares among friends, and not all the friends are, racing people or horse people. And it's sort of hard to make the case if they sense some sort of smell about it. And I think that's a great pity. And that's a great pity to see it damaged.
Yep, yep. By the key figures inside it. Andrew, thanks for your time this morning. Much appreciated. Here in Atlanta, it's my great pleasure to introduce to our colour man for Sunday. He's here to cover his 38th Super Bowl. He's one of the most revered NFL writers in America, and he is the father of a future Hall of Famer, Larry Fitzgerald Sr. Welcome to SEN.
Thank you. It's great to be with you. And I tell you, Atlanta and Super Bowl 53, Atlanta's had the Super Bowl before, and they've had some issues in terms of dealing with weather, unexpected, that type of thing. But this Super Bowl, you can't argue with the fact that they've got two terrific teams. You've got a dynasty in the Patriots, the greatest of all time in Tom Brady, and then this upstart Ram team that just hit Los Angeles by storm.
Yep. What's the Super Bowl come to mean to you over the years, Larry, having seen so much of, well, it's, you're the living history. There's banners all around Radio Row from Super Bowl I all the way through to 53, so it will trigger memories, I'm sure, with those who have covered them. You've been here for so many of them. What does the day mean?
Well, the first one for me was Super Bowl 15 between the Raiders and the Philadelphia Eagles, and it was in New Orleans. And it was at the beginning of my career, and I wanted to get a feel for how big it was to cover a world championship, the magnitude of a Super Bowl. And what I learned that week is that much can happen during the week that can have an effect on the game. And then, two, you realize that there's so much more that goes on during the week than just the game itself.
Yep.
The business, the industry, the marketing, so many things that go on during the week of the Super Bowl. It's a celebration of life for, you know, America and around the world. And so here we are at Super Bowl 38, and I've always tried to take the mindset of when you're doing a report, when you're writing a column, when you're doing a little television, take that same energy that you would have if you're doing a Super Bowl. And so that's what it's meant to me, and it's great to be here for another one.
How's it grown in that time, Larry?
It just continues to, by leaps and bounds. I mean, in the United States, there's no doubt about it, the Super Bowl is the number one rated event in television, not just in sports, but in television. And the National Football League, they got it right. They really have a unique formula from the 70s when the two leagues came together, the AFL and the NFL, and with the merger. And these two conferences, I think, are different in many ways, but yet the football is just fantastic. And with the rule changes and the fact that offense this year was probably more explosive than it's been since back in the old AFL days, the game has just been sort of recharged. And so here we have a team like the Rams. They scored 527 points, averaged 34 points a game. And then you've got the Patriots with Brady and Bill Belichick and their philosophy of doing what you have to do to win. Whatever that is, they have a game plan of preparation, of dissecting their opponent, and then taking away the elements of their opponent's best to win the game.
How vividly do you remember Atlanta 19 years ago and the ice storms which have been recounted during this week and the chaos, and the city felt it might never get the showpiece game again, and yet here we are?
Yeah, it's amazing that something that's really out of your hands can put a bad taste on the memory of many of us while we're here all week. And I remember it vividly. The weather was so bad a couple of days where the cab drivers, there were no, they call them Uber drivers and Lyft, that didn't exist back
yep.
then. You were dependent on a cab, and the cab drivers weren't driving. They hadn't driven on ice. It was frightening. You couldn't get from one event to another. So Atlanta is fortunate, but Dallas got a bad draw, too, a few years ago when storms hit that city. And it hit early in the week, much like the forecast is for this week. But as we get closer to Sunday, things should warm up.
Do you what sort of sporting town is Atlanta in your experiences?
I think it's a good sports town. I wouldn't call it a great sports town. You know, they've got the NBA and Atlanta Hawks. You know, they've had the National Hockey League come and go. Obviously, the SEC, you know, the College Football Hall of Fame. I mean, every year at Alabama seems to be playing, you know, either Georgia or LSU for, you know, supremacy in the SEC conference. And so it's a tremendous sports town. Baseball is huge here in Atlanta. I mean, you look at the baseball park they just built a couple of years ago. There's a tremendous passion for sports in this town, in this community. And it just takes turns. They hand it over to football. They hand it back over to baseball. Now, the Falcons, of course, were in the Super Bowl 3 years ago. And, boy, they were that close.
Yeah.
I mean, they had a 25-point lead on this Patriot team. And I was there. I saw it with my own eye. I still don't believe it, but they didn't win it. And that's something that you will never forget.
Jared Whateley with you in Atlanta, and with me, Larry Fitzgerald Sr., who's going to share the broadcast on Monday, Australian time. Is what makes a great Super Bowl, Larry? It's sort of a question of what makes a great Olympics, and it's usually the fusion of the town and the involvement of the city, and then great sporting moments which resonate, they echo through the years. In all of your experiences, through 37 of them, what makes a great Super Bowl?
Well, you got to have the energy right from the beginning, because there's such a build-up, and a Super Sunday seems to take quite a while. I mean, all day from the time you get up, you know, minute by minute, up to the kickoff. It's got to have something that right from the beginning, you know, kind of grabs you. And the Super Bowls are, I mean, because it's the most explosive game from the standpoint of energy, because once they finally do the national anthem and they clear the field and they start playing, man, these guys know what they're playing for.
Yep.
They're playing for that ring. That ring means everything to them. I can tell you, my son was so close years ago to win a world championship, and to see him score two touchdowns and to give his team the lead with literally a minute left, and then to literally sit there and watch the Pittsburgh Steelers, the winningest team in Super Bowl history, they've won six of them, march methodically down the field and to put a touchdown on the board with 20 seconds left was one of the greatest pains I've had to experience in terms of just pulling for your son. You want him and his efforts and his team to win the world championship, and they won three games that year, but they didn't have the home field advantage and they weren't one of the top two seeds in their conference. And so that was the penalty that they had to pay, in that they had to win four games, including the Super Bowl, to win the world championship. The Patriots and Rams are in a better position. They've only got to win three. But I want to guarantee you, it is very difficult to win four games against the 12 best teams in the National Football League. And that's why Super Bowl Sunday is something that I'm so passionate about watching, because these players really go out there to do everything they can to grab that Vince Lombardi trophy.
Did you write about the game that your son played in?
Oh, absolutely.
How did you work your way through the emotions of it to be able to write about it?
Well, it was a unique week in the sense that I'm the first sports writer in history, the only one, to cover his own son in a Super Bowl. And so that week, the media, the national media, I've got many friends in the business for many, many years, they really talked a lot about how could I be a father watching the Super Bowl, pulling for my son, cheering for my son,
yep,
they felt, and then separated from being a reporter, a writer, a talk show host. And I told them I had experience at this. I've been doing this since you know, he was a small child. And so I was able to get through it because when I cover games, I don't just cover my son. I'm obviously watching what he's doing, but I'm covering the game, and I'm trying to get a feel for, you know, the outcome, how it's decided, who played the strongest roles, and putting your piece together when you go after the game and talk to the players and coaches. So I didn't do anything different that week, although it was really difficult to, you know, to go and talk to your son and see the pain that he had.
So he's a wide receiver with the Arizona Cardinals. It's broadly regarded that he's a future Hall of Famer. And yeah. What's it been like to live through his journey and to see him succeed in a league that has obviously got a really close place to your heart?
It's been very gratifying. Our story, you may or may not know about it. My wife of 24 and a half years, Carol, she died of cancer in 2003. Larry was a first-year player with the University of Pittsburgh. He was All-American that year. And, you know, he and his mom had a little difficulty in terms of communication on how to do some things. And, you know, he didn't talk to her, you know, the last few weeks of her life. And that's something that he's had to carry with him. And he was drafted, obviously, by the Arizona Cardinals. First round, Dennis Green, who I did his radio show back in Minnesota with the Vikings for 8 years, took Larry in the first round. And he's just been an incredible player with a great passion for winning and trying to help his team win big games. And he's helped the Cardinals change their culture, become recognized as a consistent winner. This year there was a big setback in terms of where they were with, you know, Bruce Arians when he was there for 5 years. But Larry still is very passionate about winning and about trying to get a championship. And in the National Football League, as we saw this year, teams can go from last place to first place. The Dallas Cowboys did it, got to the playoffs, won a game, and we're right there. Only the Rams knocked them out.
Friday, it's the final test of the summer. It's the first time that a test will be played in the nation's capital, Manuka Oval. To have that honour, and he's at the nets. He's in the heat. He's keeping an eye on things. We're just going to distract him for a moment. The chief cricket writer from the Australian and part of our SEN Test cricket team, Peter Lawler. Pete, welcome.
Hello from the bush capital, Jerris. Umpire Maurice Erasmus just walked by before. He said, it's the first time I've been here. He says, it's like Bloemfontein.
It's 1 degree here in Atlanta, Pete. What's the temperature in Canberra, do you reckon?
It's 20. I just checked before you came. I came on. It's 29 degrees. It's very hot. Yes, we had a tropical storm last night, but you know, that's that real brutal Australian bush heat at the moment. Clear skies, very very hot.
Yeah. It's been an ambition for a few years to have a test match in Manuka. To your eye and to your knowledge, is Canberra ready? Is it ready to host test cricket?
It looks like the first 3 days are sold out or close to sold out.
Wow.
So really good feel and great little venue. They've really got it humming. They've done a lot of improvements since I was here last year even. And yeah, there's a vibe in Canberra for the test match.
So one of the questions around Manuka has been that the pitch is flat and that it hasn't lent itself yet to thrilling cricket. Well, what's the mail on what they've been able to prepare?
Yeah, there are some concerns about the wicket, I've got to say. I haven't been out to have a look at it yet this morning, but traditionally it's been flat. Once, I think we had quite an exciting wicket here, and fingers crossed they can do that. But the last thing we need is a chief executive's wicket for the first test match in Canberra. Need a bit of life. As we saw, that Brisbane test was fun because the wicket was lively, wasn't it? So, yeah, well, hopefully the wicket's better than it's been.
Okay, so what's the Australian story here, Pete? The desperation that one of the batsmen score a century. They made easy work of Sri Lanka, as you mentioned, on a lively pitch, but it sort of hasn't fooled anybody. What is there for Australia in this?
Well, you'd have to think that if someone's going to get a century, it's going to be that Marnus Labuschagne game at Shane and Marcus Harris and Travis Head all look the goods. This is their last chance to cash in at six tests this summer without a century for Australia. I'm worried about Usman Khawaja. I'm hoping he can find his feet here, and I use that term advisedly because his feet just aren't in the game at the moment. His hands are, his feet aren't. But I'm just hoping that Marnus and Travis, having got so close to 100, will be twice as hungry for one this time. But, you know, in a way, it reflects where Australian cricket's at the moment. It's a modest team, modest scores, and there's not a lot of consistent century makers in that side, is there? Yet?
Not yet. Do you think it'll be an unchanged team?
Yeah, I do. The mail from inside the dressing room is that there won't be any changes. They're hard to pick. These selectors do change their minds right up until the last minute. But they left Queensland resolving to have the same team. But they've brought in Marcus Stoinis just as an option, as an all-round option. But you'd have to think that these bowlers could get... There can't be too much concern about the condition of their bowlers. They've brought in the new lad from Richardson. And he can't be tired because he hasn't played a first-class game for 2 months, so apart from the test match. So I don't think there can't be a change, no.
Will it be a pity that Australian cricket didn't have a look at the Wonder Boy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Missed a chance there, but you know, that's cricket. I think they had good reason to bring him in, and we were all anticipating the debut of Kukowski, the 20-year-old from Victoria, who we've been hearing things about for about 10 years, to be honest, since he was about 10. So we were all disappointed about that, but it was the right thing to do. Bring in Patterson. Patterson had made 3 centuries in 8 days. And if there's one message that the selectors have given out since the start of the year is they want people who are making centuries. And he did it. So he got his chance. And he looked the goods too. We only saw him for a brief period in the middle. He made 30-odd. I mean, he was batting with the tail. I would have liked to have seen him have a better run with some people in the middle order. But he looked great. And he took a brilliant catch. Probably the best, or equal best catch of the summer up there with the one that Khawaja took to get rid of Dhoni. I think the selectors made the right decisions in Canberra, and they have to show, I mean, there's concerns about Usman Khawaja. He's had a very poor summer. He's only averaging 24, and we expected a lot more because he's the senior batsman in the side. But you have to stick with him, and you have to stick with Mitchell Starc too, I think. Just give him one more game. There's nothing to be lost. Better to give a player one more game than one fewer. But my mail was that Starc wasn't going to play in Brisbane if Hazelwood was fit. Hazelwood's injury meant that Starc got to play.
And Sri Lanka, are they capable of providing a sterner test, as it were?
Oh, I worry about them. They've lost two fast bowlers from the game in Brisbane. Their batsmen certainly weren't up to the bounce on the Gabba wicket, but there's no shame in that. I mean, there are Australian batsmen who struggle on that deck. It is the most challenging deck in Australia. But I can't see Sri Lanka winning this test match.
No, it would take a bit of imagination to do so. You wrote the piece yesterday, I think it was, Pete, and my times are a little bit out over here, about Cricket Australia is killing the golden goose that is the BBL. Was it last night in Sydney where there were 6,000 people at a Sixers game? There is a lot of traction now around this discussion. What conclusions are you drawing when you talk to people at the moment about the direction of the BBL?
Well, there's a number of issues at play if you speak to people. People say the season's too long. Now, maybe the season feels too long because none of the games are competitive. Nor are many of the games exciting because the scores are low. There's a widely held view that the pitches are not up to scratch this year and that they need to be fixed. But there's other things that need to be fixed too. They need to get international players. They need to attract international players to the Big Bash. They won't do that anymore because they have competition in the UAE and from Bangladesh, believe it or not, who, AB de Villiers has earned $450,000, which playing for the BPL this year. Yep. That's three times what he would have got for playing in the BBL for half as much work.
Now, admittedly, you got to go to Bangladesh and not Brisbane, but right, it went three times $450,000 as compared to maybe $150,000 if you're lucky. So it's a no-brainer for any cricketer, and that's going to be the way it goes. They'll lose coaches too. Coaches will take up the option to go to these alternative leagues because these alternative leagues represent more money for less work. So you've got to get some stars in just to brighten it up. And the season's too long, but I can't see them going back on that. I can't see them throwing it into reverse, but they've gone up from 35 to where are we now? Is it 59 games in 2 years? What they need to do, and this was the issue last night, is look at their scheduling, look at their fixture. What sort of madness has a double header the night before Australian kids go back to school? Now, you get away with it in Hobart because you put it on in the afternoon and Hobart doesn't get much cricket, so they showed up and it's a boutique ground. But Sydney, the night before the kids go back to school, there's a BBL game on. It's not going to work in it, and that's why they got such an embarrassing crowd. And I think the other thing is there is just too many games. I mean, if people have enough money to go to two or three Big Bash games, once upon a time they had to choose out of four or five at the SCG or in Sydney. Now they're choosing out of seven or eight. So people aren't showing up to games because people have only so much finance and so much time to attend the game. They really have overstretched the BBL this year. And my concern is that Cricket Australia aren't showing much acknowledgement of the problem. They're a little bit in denial. I keep hearing comparisons to the AFL season and the NRL season. Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, AFL and NRL, that's the peak of the competition. And both those codes learned that you can't spread your games through the week because people get sick of them. That's why they isolate them around the weekends. BBL's on every night. It's like wallpaper. They just need to be careful. Having said all of that, there'll be 1 million people attend the BBL by the end of this month, and that's a fantastic thing. It's still a great product, and it's still probably one of the best things that Cricket Australia's ever done.
Thanks for listening to the Best of Waitley podcast. This is just a sampling of the topics we covered on air. If your ears are burning for more, you can head to sen.com.au. For now, whether it's on the dial, a smartphone, or even a smartwatch, thanks for joining us on 11:16 SEN. We'll be back to do it all again tomorrow from 9.